I really wish to thank you for inviting me to this symposium. As you can hear, it's a lot of emotion for me. I might have to give you a little bit of an explanation for my somewhat cryptic title, François Jacob's Scientific Legacy, Toolbox and Idea Box. I should insist on Idea Box, to study infectious diseases. Today we've heard a lot about François as being the pioneer or one pioneer in the field of molecular biology, microbial genetics, and then in a way switching to eukaryotes and development biology. We've heard Jean-Pierre saying, you know, good things and bad things about bacteria. I would like to say that, and maybe you don't realize it, François and his colleagues were really, in a way, suggesting to us something that had to do with the possibility to study the pathogenesis or the mechanisms of bacterial infections. And I thought this should be said very clearly tonight. So basically, several of us who sort of started this discipline in the mid-1970s to late 1970s, and I would cite here people like Stanley Falco and John McElhanos in the United States, we basically all essentially started to dissect out this pathogenic process of bacteria by using the toolbox and idea box, which has been, well, had been left to us by François and his colleagues. Myself, I got into the field as a you know, intern des Hôpitaux de Paris. I was interested and in a way frustrated to see that there was so little done about understanding the mechanisms of infections. And there was one mecca, of course, which was Institut Pasteur, if you wanted to learn at that time and still about the pathogenesis of infections and you know, pathogenic microbes, but also getting some basic training in molecular genetics, which was obviously essential to do this. So the place was at Institut Pasteur, and I got this Roux Fellowship, and I could follow the Grand Cours de l'Institut Pasteur. And immediately we were exposed at that time, and we should still, to essential papers, manuscripts, which essentially constructed, provided the elements to do what we dream, or what I dream personally to do. So we had these papers about bacterial conjugation and interrupted transfer, giving the impression that we could essentially transfer genes from not necessarily model organisms, but pathogens into model organisms and start asking questions about what these, you know, exotic genes would do in these model microorganisms. All this work on the interrupted transfer and showing basically the circularity of the bacterial genome. And of course, because a lot of the pathogenesis study started from there, the work on episome and the concept of episomes, which soon would become plasmid, but basically this was a series of essential elements. And this was actually, as I said in my title, my idea box and toolbox, and I should say toy box in a way, to start learning and essentially applying this knowledge to study pathogenesis of infection. For this, I selected one microorganism that was at the end of the 70s, which is called Shigella, essentially Shigella flexneri. And I was interested because as an infectious disease person, of course, I was quite concerned about all these infectious diseases, especially in the developing world, which were killing young children. So Shigella is essentially invading the epithelium, the intestinal epithelium in the colon of these young children, causes this massive inflammation, tissue destruction, and this is sort of the battlefield, and we had, I had to try to make sense out of it. So of course, you have to go by your reductionist approach, start with the microbes and then expose the microbes to cells and then expose these microbes after the exposure to cells to animal models. So this is kind of the scheme that you would follow. And I went immediately tapping into this toolbox that had been left to us by François Jacob and especially Elie Volman, who was on one of the previous pictures. So basically what I quickly demonstrated is that Shigella flexneri, these invasive microorganisms of the gut, had a large virulence plasmid. When the plasmid was lost, the bacterium would not invade cells, would not be pathogenic anymore. When the plasmid was painfully transferred into Escherichia coli K12, suddenly E. coli K12 became able to penetrate into epithelial cells in cultures, and that was a bit of the beginning of what was now called cellular microbiology. But whenever you would expose this Escherichia coli K12, which had received this virulence plasmid from Shigella, to a more complicated animal models, and I didn't show you the model because it would hurt some susceptible personalities, this is exactly what we saw, which is that nothing happened. Basically, this microbe, in spite of the fact that it could penetrate into the cells, was not pathogenic. So that was the beginning of thinking that this was sort of a multigenic process. And what I did was to essentially prepare two HFR strains from Shigella flexneri that would transfer their chromosome in opposite direction. And on the top of this E. coli K12 that had received this plasmid, I started to get genes from the chromosome of Shigella flexneri to penetrate. And very soon I realized that there was at least one marker, histidine biosynthesis, which was constantly associated with the sort of getting this E. coli K12 to become absolutely invasive and destructive in this experimental model. So that was sort of using all these tools that had been made available to us to sort of start dissection of pathogenesis of microorganisms. And I will come back on this His locus because there is an interesting turn that occurred recently in the lab. So a large part of the pathogenesis of Shigella is linked to this virulence plasmid. What this virulence plasmid does, as we know now after many years of research, is that it encodes a very nice machine, a molecular machine, which is called a type 3 secretion system, which is a molecular syringe that spans the inner and outer membrane of Shigella. And through this channel here, it has the capacity to inject effector molecules that will essentially allow the bacterium, first of all, to penetrate into epithelial cells. And I'm not going to get into of the details of this because this has been published over and over again. What is interesting is that this type 3 secretion system is encoded by two operons, which are transcribed in a similar direction. And in opposite direction, we have a series of what's called EPA molecules, which are constitutively expressed as the temperature is switched on to 37 degrees. And these molecules are stored in the bacterial compartment, ready to go through the type 3 secretion system whenever it gets activated when the bacterium hits the surface of its target cell. It is this pool of cells of proteins which are forming structures at the tip of the type 3 secretion system and that allow to form a channel which allows the bacterium to inject these molecules into eukaryotic cells. So that is an interesting aspect because the plasmid is a lot more sophisticated than this. There is actually a complex system that has been sorted out by Claude Parceau in the lab, which allows the bacterium to sense the opening, the activation of the type 3 secretion system, and through the release of one inhibition molecule, which is called FB, through the type 3 secretion system, it releases a couple of molecules, MXIE, and another one, ICSB, which will get together and form these transcription factors that activates the expression of other molecules, other genes, the OSP, the EPAH genes, which will be secreted as a second wave. And it turns out that a lot of these molecules which are secreted at the second wave are molecules that are going to alter the innate immune response to decrease the inflammation that the bacterium is causing by aggressing the tissues. So this is just summarizing 30 years of work in one slide. It's kind of difficult, but the bacterium is entering into these M cells that lie over the lymphoid structure associated with the mucosal tissues. They kill macrophages through the expression of this type 3 secretion system, especially one molecule, IPA-B, and this causes the release of IL-1 beta, which initiates inflammation. That's called pyroptosis. Then the bacterium is released in the subepithelial tissues and start its cell biology duty, which is to, through the expression of this type 3 secretion system and effector molecules again, enter through actin remodeling. Then it escapes into the cytosol and through this ICSA molecule polymerizes actin and moves from one cell to another. It's kind of an underground sort of colonization process. So that was sort of 20 years initially trying to dissect out these molecular and cellular mechanisms, and then Guitran Van Dieu, who is here, participated a lot in these discoveries. But there was another aspect which we didn't so much consider at the beginning, which was inflammation. The bacterium needs inflammation to help it disrupt the epithelial barrier and invade more efficiently. And it does it essentially by invading initially the cells, and this is going to release some microbial products, especially the peptidoglycan. And thanks to this peptidoglycan, we could, more than 10 years ago now with Dana Philpott in the lab, identify the node molecules as intracellular sensors of bacteria through the perception of this peptidoglycan. Massive inflammation. What do you do with this when you are microorganisms? You die. So what the bacterium has to do very quickly, and the timing of the events is still a question mark, is to essentially inject these effector molecules to dampen, to downregulate the expression of these pro-inflammatory cascade. And of course, what is downstream of this pro-inflammatory cascade, which is expression of antimicrobial peptide, which kill bacteria by inserting in membranes, attraction of polymorphonuclear cells, which engulf bacteria and kill them, and so on and so forth. So this is a very complicated scheme that has been dissected out step by step by our group, and also in some aspects by some other groups. Altogether, this is the scheme. I would just like to say a little word about these very fascinating effector molecules of the first, for some of them, like IPGD, and of the second wave, like OSG, OSF, and IPA-Hs. They're all enzymes, so there is this catalytic dimension which allows to enhance their effect when they are injected into the cells, of course. IPGD is a phosphatidyl phosphatase which hydrolyzes PI45P into PI5P, and it has a strong anti-inflammatory potential, as I will show you. OSG is also a kinase that plays around with the NF-kappa-B cascade. I cannot get into the details. And it's also an anti-inflammatory molecule. OSPAF is a fascinating molecule, which is a phosphothreonine lyase, which basically goes to the nucleus and regulates the expression of anti-inflammatory genes by largely epigenetic activity. IPA-Hs, as we've shown, are a family or new family of ubiquitin ligases. So we have all this arsenal, all this artillery of effector molecules that the bacterium possesses to lure, to subvert the immune system. For instance, this is the work of Laurence Harbib. Laurence has shown that this OSPF molecule is actually injected into the cell, goes to the nucleus of the target cells. There it binds or docks, you would say, to HP1 gamma, and from there it expresses this activity of being a phosphothreonine lyase, which is that basically he dephosphorylates molecules, especially the MAP kinases like P38 or ERK1 and ERK2. And this complex of molecules is essential, of course, to promote gene transcription because they are very active on the polymerase. But they also, through a very complex pathway that has been recently deciphered, cause changes in phosphorylation of histone. And this contributes to increase the constraint of the chromatin and essentially close a lot of the pro-inflammatory genes on the cell chromosome. So these are extremely original, I would say, systems. And as you can see here, an effect of the injection of this molecule in the nucleus is actually to shut down the expression of interleukin 8, which is a major cytokine or chemokine that attracts polymorphonuclear cells to the epithelium. So it's kind of the bacterium being stealth and hiding itself from the polymorphonuclear cells. Any mutant in the OspF gene, actually, they have a much stronger, much pathogenic phenotype on the experimental model that we are testing. So you can be even more severe and more pathogenic than a wild-type Shigella. Another example of this is this molecule IPGD, which I just mentioned, and this is Andrea Pua, the postdoc who did the work in collaboration also with Guy. This Shigella injects these molecules into the cells. But as any microbial pathogen engages epithelial cells, there is a dangerous signaling cascade which is induced, which we had not noticed before, which is linked to the release or quick release of ATP through hemi channels. You see it here with this system here, for instance. A wild-type microorganism doesn't induce a lot of release of this ATP molecule, but the IPGD mutant, which clearly shuts the system down, when we have a mutant, now we have a lot of ATP which is released. And ATP is a very potent pro-inflammatory molecule. Whenever it is released in the extracellular milieu, it activates some of its receptor and causes a sort of snowball effect, which induces more and more release of this ATP molecule. Though this is sending a strong signal of alert to the host that it is engaged by these microorganisms. Thus, this IPGD molecule, which leads to a depletion in the pool of phosphatidylinositol 4,5, as well as the production of PI5P, which, as we've shown in this paper, is actually inducing the closing of the hemi channels, thus ATP remains in the cells, and this is a shutting off of these pro-inflammatory signals. So this is the kind of trick that Shigella uses, and again, if you make a mutation in IPGD, this is the phenotype. There is no more intestinal mucosa. It's like the mutant is hypervirulent, as much as I said before for OspF, and that doesn't necessarily make too much sense, because supposedly at the end of the day, a pathogen should enhance its fitness, but it may not wish, if I may say, to be more virulent, because it might kill its host and might be killed itself because it's too much seen by the immune system, and this might be a sort of end or dead end in the host. So there are lots of discussions and reflections now that sort of rotate around the idea of pathogenesis versus fitness, and this is something that I will address now in the second part of my presentation. So pathogenicity and fitness, and of course all this has to be seen in the perspective of evolution, and especially the evolution of pathogens and their hosts. Question, in a way, you could ask is, why are there pathogens? What's the sense of being a pathogen when you could live happily in a quiet environment like Escherichia coli K12 in the gut of a person and be transmitted by whatever means you can think of to another person? So that is still an issue which is not yet addressed, and the question is whether pathogenicity increases fitness, for instance, and vice versa. So we have an array of mutants that we have identified and we have analyzed the phenotypes. Some of them are completely blocking pathogenesis, others have intermediate phenotypes, and others, as I just showed, have an increased pathogenic phenotype. So what is the meaning of all this? We are in this field more and more interested in a more global view of things, and this is where the concept of fitness is coming in. We need to understand how the bacterium colonizes the host at the first stage, how it competes with the local microbiota, which has a barrier effect, how it colonizes, how it survives on the surface against all these defense mechanisms, how it is transmitted from one host to another. These are all issues which have to be integrated, and where the fitness concept is coming in. But if we wish to do this, we need to improve our approaches, and I will quickly finish on these two aspects. We need to have more relevant animal models. The rabbit longitudinal loop that I mentioned is not a good model, at least not perfect. It doesn't address the issue of the real target, the colon. In this case, we were looking at the ileum. There is a closure, so there is no motility. There is nothing that challenges the microorganisms in terms of colonizing efficiently. The non-virulent microbes, they survive in this environment quite well. So there are issues there. And also, we need a more relevant screening process. We need to have a much broader genome-wide mutagenesis approach if we wish to put this sort of library of genome-wide mutants into the system and see at the end who is surviving, who is not surviving. And this needs to be done, especially in the case of Shigella. Improving the animal model, this is not an animal model, this is a human colonic tissue explant which is infected with a GFP expressing Shigella. So this is the surface of the colon, this is the entry of the intestinal crypt, and what you will see on this short movie, which is based on two-photon microscopic analysis, is that the bacteria are essentially getting into the crypt at the periphery, at the orifice, and then they go inside, and they grow inside. And this is the actual target of Shigella in the colon. So that was important because we had to define an animal model which would essentially reproduce this particular tropism of Shigella on the crypt. And this is an important issue because this is opening a new dimension to the topic, because the crypt is the site of epithelial generation, regeneration. This is where the stem cells are located. And if the bacterium, by any means, as we've shown recently with commensal microorganisms, can affect the stem cells, either in good, in their survival, or in bad, in their killing, you might think that this is going to have a very strong impact on the evolution of the disease, because if the epithelium cannot be regenerated, the disease is going to be a lot more severe. So we ended up, and I make a long story short here, finding that the guinea pig actually has this capacity to reproduce the essential characteristics of entering into the crypts and inducing this strict inflammation in the colon after 8 hours of interaction. So this is a work that sort of shows you how we have to improve our visibility on the experimental model, make things quantitative in order to ensure that we are dealing with the proper systems. This is work by Hélène Arena and Jean-Yves Thivenaz at Institut Pasteur. And what we did was to essentially look at this infected colon from this animal doing this Swiss roll and spotting all the sites where bacteria had invaded the mucosa. And then from there, going through these tiding facilities and the acquisition of all these different foci, we started to educate the machine so that it gives us the coordinates of the microorganisms as they penetrate or as they remain outside or penetrate into the tissues. And the coordinates give a sort of depth of progression as well as lateral extensions in reference to a line which is supposed to be based on statistics and probabilistic, constantly reorganize the line of surface of the epithelium. So this is taking a lot of memory and they work this out quite properly. And at the end of the day, what is quite interesting here is to look at the time scale of evolution of the events. This is the synthesis or the mean of all the crypts, and there are hundreds and hundreds of them which has been looked at. This reddish is color is the invasive microbe, the bluish color is a non-invasive mutant. And what you can see, surprisingly, after 2 hours, that there are more non-invasive mutants entering into these crypts and even being taken probably by inflammatory cells because they cause a bit of inflammation, but then they go away. And these non-invasive microbes, they just disappear, even from the lumen, which was not seen in the previous model. At the same time, the wild-type microorganisms takes its way down to the bottom of the crypts, and as you see here, diffuses out around. So this was a nice way to start to calibrate a system which reflects the disease. Now we have this system, and we can go back to genetics, and what we decided to do was to do TNSEC. And TNSEC is basically you construct a large library of Shigella mutants, hundreds of thousands, million mutants, so that you have basically a transposon that is inserted into about every two or three nucleotides. And now having this library in your hands, you go for TN sequencing, so you break the DNA from this pool of microorganisms which have undergone the mutagenesis, use poly-CTL to purify the fragments, a second round of PCR to put a primer for Illumina sequencing. And what you can do by deep sequencing on this pool of microorganisms is essentially by referring to where the transposon is located, identify which gene is concerned by the insertion of the transposon, but also count the number of genes which are present in this mixture so that you have a fairly good view, you know, sequence after sequence after sequence after sequence of the respective number of mutants in this pool of microorganisms. So what you do, and this is what two postdocs in the lab, Benoit Martin, who is now actually a researcher in CERM, and Mark Anderson, an American postdoc, is to generate this huge library of TN10 transposon mutants in Shigella flexneri. We have 10 to the 7 mutants, so that's 10 million mutants. That's about 8,000 coverage on a gene basis, which tells you that, you know, basically your genome is saturated. You basically take only, of course, the ones that have not altered functionally the bacterium, the ones that would not grow very well in vitro. You don't want to deal with this. These are essential genes. So we just want the ones that do not affect the growth of the bacteria. Then you take one part with no selection and you proceed to this TNSEC procedure. And then the other one is put through this animal model that, as we say it now, has been validated to be very close to human disease. And we go the same way for this. And here now we sort of, after the deep sequencing of the two samples, the ones that have not been exposed to the animal, the one that has been exposed to the animal model, we can basically count the number of genes and from there basically identify the fact that the bacterium has lost its fitness in this global system. So either you find this, which shows that there is no effect of the mutation, either you find this, which is not very interesting, but what we are looking for is this kind of situation where you have 5,500 copies of the gene, which means that there are 4,000 microbes in the pool, and then the mutant goes down to zero, showing that it has lost its fitness due to this mutation. So based on this, we have been able to sort of revisit the global genome of Shigella flexneri, the plasmid, as well as the chromosome. When you look at the plasmid, for instance, you see a lot of these events that I mentioned where there is a decrease in the numbers. So there is clearly a loss of fitness for most of the pathogenicity mutation that we had identified before. This is true for the type 3 secretion system. This is true for a certain number of effectors. Well, it's just an emotion that is just in front of your eyes. So if I pick up some of these mutants which I mentioned before, for instance, the IPB, IPAC, IPAD, which are major effectors that allow the bacteria to enter into the epithelial cells, you see that the decrease of fitness is very high. It's almost 1,500 to 1,000. For this strain. One molecule, IPA-A, which is a bit downstream, so there is no polar effect here that has to be feared, has a very limited effect. And the one that causes cell-to-cell spread, on the other hand, very disappointedly, has very little effect in terms of loss of fitness. So we are going from surprises to surprises. And the last slide is sort of showing our last surprise. I'm going back to this His locus that I mentioned in my a la Volman and Jacobs experiments. The His locus, now when you have identified the co-transfer of one of these markers with something that causes pathogenesis or fitness increase, you just work on the chromosome and look for something interesting. And we immediately found what was interesting is this RFC gene. This RFC gene is a gene that encodes the linking of lipopolysaccharide O side chains to the core of the lipopolysaccharide. And the absence of these O side chains is making the microbe extremely susceptible to antimicrobial peptides or to complement if it became systemic. So what this screen picked is actually this gene, which is called RFC, or now in the new nomenclature, YZZY. I will never be able to adapt to this. And this is essentially a gene encoding this O antigen polymerase, which allows the constriction of the LPS O side chains. So I will finish here, just sort of closing the loop, and we started with the early stage of bacterial genetics. We adapted these tools to our pathogenesis study, and my message here is that microbial genetics and genetic approach is still an essential component of these studies. We've done a lot of cell biology, immunology, and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, the real thing is there in the heart of the microbial genome. And this is a sort of new wave of approach by having these sort of global studies. And thank you very much for your attention.